motivates our charitable giving? How can we make our favorite charities more effective? And how can nonprofits encourage more people to give? Those are some of the questions we'll answer this hour with the co-author of The Y-Axis. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, November 12th. We will discuss how our guest and his co-author conducted field experiments looking for the incentives that motivate human behavior in a wide variety of situations. We will learn what they learned and how the Y-axis can be applied to problems large and small. And we'll welcome your questions and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What really motivates people and why? What triggers it? What incentives are needed to motivate people to stay out of trouble, to get better grades in school, to perform better on the job, to discriminate less against others, to give more to charity, and more? Our guest is John List, a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and research associate with the National Bureau of Economics. He's a native of Sun Prairie and received his bachelor's degree at UW-Stevens Point. He is the co-author of The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Good morning. Oops, are you there, John? Well, John,
yes, good morning, Joy. It's nice to be on the air.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you okay, yeah.
All right, good. Welcome to a fellow pointer. I went to UW-Stevens Point as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Tell us how being a UW-Stevens Point student studying economics and being a sports card dealer motivated your work in this field.
Sure, sure. When I was up at Point studying economics, every weekend my girlfriend and I would go to sports card shows around Madison and Milwaukee and Chicago. And what we would do at those shows is we would buy, sell, and trade. And in buying, selling, and trading, we would actually test important economic theories at those sports card shows.
Like what?
Well, things like, what are the best ways to negotiate a good deal would be one very important thing as a sports card dealer. Another one would be what to look for when consumers come to actually purchase a good from your table at a sports card show. What are the best ways to negotiate with them?
Mm-hmm. And you decided it would be interesting to not just study this in a textbook, but to go out and actually conduct experiments out in the real-life field.
That's exactly right. So when you look at what we did at the sports card shows, it was actually a very small-scale representation of the real world or real markets in the real world. And that led me to thinking about exactly how can I use the world as my laboratory. And ever since then, now we were running those original experiments back in 1987, and ever since then, we've run experiments in all kinds of different labor markets and all kinds of different product markets. We've gone to India. We've worked with hundreds and hundreds of charities to figure out, for example, why do people give to charitable causes? So in essence, most of your listeners have probably been subjects in some of my field experiments.
That's interesting. And I do want to talk a little bit about what motivates us to give to charity. But first, let's talk a little bit about this field in general. This is called behavioral economics?
That's right.
And what exactly is that, and how does it work?
Yeah, so when you think about behavioral economics, essentially what it does is it tries to actually understand how to use psychology or how to use sociology to understand our economic motivations and why we do things. So, for example, one aspect that people oftentimes have within their preference set, and what I mean by that is one aspect that drives people's choices is that losses are felt more than comparable gains. So, for example, if I can leverage the fact that people actually really dislike losses, I can then understand better how to motivate them to do what I want them to do.
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure, absolutely. So one example is when we think about incentivizing school teachers. It's very contentious down here in Chicago about whether school teachers should be paid for their performance. So one thing that you can do is you can tell school teachers, look, if your students perform at the end of the school year, you will receive a bonus. In fact, that actually doesn't work very well. But what does work really well is if you give teachers the bonus at the beginning of the school year and you tell them, if your kids do not achieve, you will have to pay us back all or part of that bonus at the end of the school year. And that threat of losing the bonus actually leads school teachers to work harder, and in essence, it leads their kids to actually perform better than those school teachers who receive the traditional bonus.
Well, that sounds like threatening people with the stick rather than giving them the carrot.
It's a little bit like that, but it operates similar to that, but it actually works really well if a person has the money in hand and they have to give it back. So it leverages both, that you have to give back money, and it leverages the fact that people really don't like sticks. They like,
right, you get
they
the,
don't really
I guess...
like to be by the stick and have to give up money.
Right, I understand that. But it's I'm just trying to grasp why I wouldn't work hard to get the bonus, whereas I would work hard to keep the bonus. What, you know, the difference there?
Yeah, so the psychology behind that is that it just hurts a lot more to lose something than it helps you to gain something. It's a phenomenon called loss aversion, and it's a general feature in many people's preferences that they just like to avoid losing something.
Wow. All right. Well, that's interesting. So you do have several chapters in the book on the psychology of giving to charity. What makes people donate?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, where I start in the charitable sector is just the enormity of it is just unbelievable. When you look at, in the U.S. alone, annual individual giving now exceeds 2% of GDP, and roughly 90% of people give money to at least one cause annually. So this sector is an extremely large and important sector in our economy. Yet we know very little about why people actually give to charitable causes. Now, what we've been doing is we've been partnering with various organizations and running field experiments. Now, how that works is, for example, if we're running a mail solicitation, we will actually send different letters to different households in an effort to figure out what is driving people to give to charitable causes. Now, in the typical charity drive, what we find is that it's a warm glow feeling that donors get, and that's what drives them to give money to a charitable cause. Now, I should be very clear here. What that means is that the traditional definition that altruism drives charity is more or less wrong. What we find is that it's not giving out of altruism. It's actually giving because it makes the donor feel good about herself, and that in and of itself is a very important motivator behind why people give to typical charitable causes. Now, there's one caveat to that, and that's when people give to things like natural disasters in the Philippines, which has recently happened.
Right. In fact, we just heard a program, just a heart-wrenching program, of people looking for their loved ones in the Philippines. It's such a horrific tragedy. So what does your research say about why we would give to a natural disaster like the typhoon in the Philippines?
Exactly. So what happens in these cases? Now, these end up being very special cases where it's very clear that humanity needs help, And in these cases, you do find that altruism is extremely important, that people are opening up their wallets because they really do want to help others. This is a one case in these experiments that we've been running for years now where you do really find an outpouring of gifts due to altruism.
Yeah. What does your research say anything about the best way to ask for donations in a situation like the typhoon?
Yeah. So the research would suggest that it's really important that you detail the exact benefits that each dollar a person gives will lead to for the recipients. And whenever you're dealing with altruism, it's really important that potential givers understand exactly how productive their dollars are going to be and how many kids or families those dollars will end up helping. Now, that's not typically the case. In a typical drive, it's more about telling the donor how they will feel better, and that's what I mean by warm glow. So in the typical drive, what works best is detailing how the donor himself benefits from his gift. In times of strife or tragedy, it's better to reverse that and focus on the recipient's benefits.
I get it. We are talking about what motivates us to do what we do, what motivates us to give to charity. What motivates you? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking with John List. He is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and he is the co-author of the book, The Why Axis: Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about what really motivates people and why with the co-author of The Why Axis. And we are welcoming your questions about human behavior and what triggers it, why we do what we do. And we are wondering why you give to charity. Why do you give to, say, the typhoon disaster relief? Or why do you give to Wisconsin Public Radio? Are the reasons different? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is John List, who is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and a research associate with the National Bureau of Economics. So we're talking about what motivates us to give to charity. And how did you research this? What did how did you do field experiments on charitable giving?
Sure. We actually look at all kinds of different ways to run our experiments. We do things like door-to-door solicitations. We do things like telethons. But most importantly, we rely on mail solicitations. And how this works is that we typically partner with an organization that is doing good for humanity. And they typically have, roughly 1 to 10 million mailers every year. And we vary different economic and psychological aspects of those letters, the way that we reach out and ask people to test our various theories within economics and psychology. So the typical field experiment, we will send mailers to roughly, say, 1 to 2 million households. We will then look at how they respond to those mailers in terms of how many households actually give and how much money they give to our cause, and then we test our various theories. Now one interesting finding that we have recently gotten is from a charity called Smile Train, where we've now sent out over 8 million mail solicitations, and what we find is that when we use a once-and-done campaign, and what I mean by once-and-done campaign is that we actually tell people that if you give now and check a box, we will never contact you again. And this campaign actually works really, really well. It raises about twice as much money as Smile Train's best campaign, other than once and done.
Well, what's going on there? We don't want to be bothered again?
Yeah, you know what? I think a major part of that is that the one very powerful asset that the charity has is they have the power of communication. So, you know, they can send you a letter or call you pretty much whenever you want. So when donors feel that they've given up that power of communication, donors actually reciprocate, and they're much kinder and give more money to the charity. And you know what else is that only about 34% of people check the box. So after the initial drive, you actually raise just as much money in the once and done as you do in the other treatments, just because people continue to give to Smile Train, even though you've given them that option to opt out. Many people actually don't opt out.
Well, how does Smile Train get in touch with them again? They just the people remember and send a check down the road anyway?
Well, what happens is once a person gives to an organization like Smile Train, they receive one letter roughly per month. So a typical charitable organization, once they build a donor pyramid of donors who have given, they are constantly contacted to give again.
Yeah, but what about the people who opted out? They're not supposed to contact them.
Absolutely, which they don't. So 34% of people opt out, so they never contact them again. But from the other 66% of people, they give a tremendous amount of money, and they make the once-and-done campaign actually worthwhile.
I see. I get it. We have a caller, Heidi in Appleton. Hi, Heidi.
Good morning.
What motivates you to give to charity?
Well, two different things. First, you said, why do people give to Wisconsin Public Radio? And I give to Wisconsin Public Radio because I've been listening, oh, my gosh, probably 35 years. And I love the extensive reporting on so many different issues. So hooray for Wisconsin Public Radio. But as far as our major gifts, this is motivated through our Christian faith. About 35 years ago, we were part of a faith community. We knew these people. We trusted them. They were not Looney Tunes. And all of them tithed. I'd never even heard of that before. But the idea of giving 10% off the top for God's work. And this was just the strangest idea. What do? Throw dollar bills up in the air? But we decided to try it because people said, once you do this, you'll never go back again. And we actually pulled money out of savings to do this. And it was just remarkable that that first time we gave, it was like the heavens opened up and all these things that for example, I'd been looking for a job for months, and within a week I had three offers for a job, and I just had a baby, and I got a box of clothes from a friend of my mom, business suits and shoes that all fit me. So that was our first experience, my first experience, where it was like God saying, yeah, this is all real, I'm here. We do not give to get. That was sort of like, honeymoon phase. Now we give, and it is a tremendous exercise of our faith to always take what we have, keep our hand open, and turn around and give that back to church or disaster out of just obedience and love for God.
Well, yeah. Heidi, I don't mean to. We have news coming up in just a little more than a minute. John, what about giving for religious reasons?
Absolutely. I think that the caller brings up an extremely interesting point. When you look at the data, roughly 58% of charitable giving in the U.S. is for religious causes. So it ends up being a very important part of the sector. And, economists have come down to two general explanations for why people are giving to religious causes. One, comes down to the fact that people are trying to ensure a just afterlife. Mm-hmm. And another one is that many people are using the church as a social network, and it's a form of social insurance in case that they have a really bad fact in their life where they have an unemployment spell or they have some illness within the family where they need some resources to help make it through. But I think what the listener brings up is exactly right. Many people are giving to God because it's the right thing to do, and it's correct to open your heart and give to an organization that is wedded to helping the poor and helping people in need.
So, let me hold you there because we do have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up next, and then we'll continue talking about human motivation after this news. We are talking about the economics of everyday decisions and what motivates us and why. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Tuesday, November the 12th. We are talking with the co-author of The Why Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. We've been talking quite a bit about what motivates us to give to charities, and we'll talk some more about that in this half hour, but we'll also broaden it to other situations, talk about how we can use what our guest learned in getting a better deal even when we go shopping. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is John List, a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and research associate at the National Bureau of Economics. He's a native of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and he received his bachelor's degree at UW-Stevens Point. His most recent book is The Why Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Before we move on, John, what do you mean by the why axis? What does that mean?
Sure. So it should be pointed out that it's actually spelled out W-H-Y. And, you know, what we mean is that typically people think of economists as measurement folks, but what the book is about is we're going after questions based on, you know, the whys that we commonly see in modern economies. For example, why do women earn less money than men? Why do people discriminate against each other? Why do inner city schools continue to underperform? And we've been talking about so far much in this hour, why do people give to charitable causes? So we're not only interested in measuring what's happening in the real world, but also why does it happen?
Yeah. And what's so hidden about the motive?
Well, in many cases, the motives are actually hidden, and sometimes they're even hidden from ourselves. When we think about how we ourselves are behaving in the world, many times we do things without even knowing what are the underlying motivations driving us to act in a certain way. So that's what we mean by hidden, is that on the surface, many times behaviors, we think they're driven by one thing. For example, in charity, we think altruism is a very important driver or motivator of behaviors. But what we end up finding is that it's not altruism at all. It ends up being the fact that people want to give because they get a warm glow feeling from giving.
Yeah. So we are motivated by self-interest, perhaps more than anything else?
I think that's exactly right. What the book really comes down to around all of these questions is the idea of self-interest is a very important driver of behaviors. And that tells you then, once we understand what people value, whether it's money or whether it's fame or whether it's to get even, it might be revenge, regardless of what that is, once we understand what motivates people, then we've really figured out why people behave the way they do.
Yeah. So why do we discriminate against other people?
You know, that's a really interesting question. You mentioned I was from Sun Prairie, and that's exactly right. Every day, you know, 20 years ago, I would actually drive a truck from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin to downtown Chicago to deliver paper products for my father's trucking company out of Sun Prairie. And in some of those cases, we would be treated rather rudely when we would show up at the loading dock here in Chicago. And I started thinking about, you know, why am I being discriminated against here? And economists have two basic models. One model is people discriminate because of hatred or animus or bigotry. They just want to hurt the other person. Now, another totally different type of model, but equally as derisive, is, you know, people discriminate against others not because they hate them, but because they want to make more money. And what I mean by that is when you have a consumer walk up to your used car shop, or if Amazon.com has a consumer logging on to their website, those sellers are actually sizing up these consumers, and they're trying to figure out what is the best way to give this person the right price so I can make the most money from them. It's not that they hate them or they despise their color or gender or age. It's just that they want to discriminate because they want to make as much money as possible.
I'm just wondering, because I saw it in some of your material, what then explains a shop owner who shoes Oprah Winfrey out of a store instead of taking her gazillion dollars to buy a purse?
Exactly. that's a great question. You know, what shop owners typically do is they size up a customer. When the customer comes to the door, they size them up and they look at their gender, they look at their race, and they try to guess, you know, how much will this person buy from me and how much are they willing to pay for my product. And it's not perfect, but what they do is they use those observable characteristics and then they formulate a plan of how they will negotiate with them. Now, in Oprah's specific case, what she had working against her is her race. So the shop owner in Zurich said, look, this is an African-American woman who comes into my shop. Now, typically, African-American women cannot afford the bags that I'm selling, so I'm going to treat her rudely because she's probably not a real shopper who will spend real money. Uh-huh. Now, in that case, of course, she was very, very wrong. Oprah was more than willing to buy a bag, but because that person was essentially discriminating based on her characteristic of race, she lost out on that sale. But in general, this statistical profiling or racial profiling in this case, in general that works, but in that particular case it doesn't. Now, when I say works, I mean that the person uses that approach to make as much money as they possibly can. So an example of that is, let's think about car insurance. When I was at Sun Prairie High School, I had two good friends. One was a 17-year-old boy, and the other was a 17-year-old girl who happened to be his twin sister. When you looked at what they paid for car insurance, the boy actually paid 20% more than the girl.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can ask yourself, well, why is the boy paying more? Why is the boy being discriminated against?
Because he's getting in more accidents, isn't he?
Fact of the matter is that he gets in more accidents, so he should have to pay more money. This is exactly what was happening with Oprah.
I don't quite get that, but I get why the shop, you know, the clerk made a big mistake.
Yeah.
She thought that she was going to be wasting her time and not making money with Oprah. So
exactly.
So the idea is to
maximize their own profits, they act in a certain way. She didn't want to waste her time with Oprah. She'd rather spend her time on a client who she thought would be more likely to buy the bag. And it's similar to the insurance case. You price or treat people in certain ways because you think that they're going to act according to a statistical model. The model's not always right, but on average it gets it about right.
Yeah, you also found out that if you have a handicap of some sort, that's correlated with being charged higher prices for, like, cars or car repairs?
Exactly. So that's a very keen insight, Joy. What we find is that when we sent out disabled people to have their cars repaired around Chicago, what we found is that they received price quotes that were about 30% higher than when we had abled people go to these same mechanics to have similar fixes to their vehicles. Now, what we found later is that if the disabled people who were shoppers confined to wheelchairs, when they go back to different auto mechanic shops and they mention, I'm getting a few price quotes today, that ends up making that 30% difference disappear.
Why?
So the idea is, if you're discriminated against based on the fact that the mechanics thought that the people in wheelchairs would not go out and shop around, if the people in wheelchairs could send a signal to the auto mechanics that indeed they were willing to go and shop around, then the auto mechanics treated them exactly as they treated the non-disabled.
Oh, my goodness. Because I couldn't figure out why. Now I see what you're saying. Well, I don't know if you did an experiment with men versus women, but we sometimes get the feeling that auto mechanics are discriminating against women versus men. Is that a part? Did you look into that?
No, you're exactly right. So actually, the discrimination against women runs really, really deep. Those were some of the first experiments that I was running at sports card shows, because what a general belief amongst sellers is that women do not negotiate as hard as men negotiate. And that's for used cars, it's for mechanic repairs, and it's for a broad array of goods and services. So the sellers actually seize upon that by attempting to charge women higher prices than men. And we have several studies now that show that, again, a woman has to signal that she is willing to be a hard bargainer and she is willing to walk away from the negotiations. And when she can signal that, she will receive the same sorts of prices that men receive. But if she doesn't signal that, then indeed she will pay a higher price than a man.
We will. We'll talk about wage gaps coming up and other economics of everyday decisions and what motivates people to do what they do. We are talking with John List. He is the co-author of The Why Access: Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Call in with your why question. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 10 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, November 12th. We are talking about what motivates people, why people do what they do, with the author of The Why Access, John List. And we're welcoming your questions, maybe your examples, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we do have a caller. Victor in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, John. I can give you excellent example of what you're discussing that happened here in Milwaukee. One issue is we had two major malls here in the north side, that's anywhere above Wisconsin Avenue. Generally, Wisconsin Avenue is a downtown strip as a marker. and there was a changing demographic as more and more black Milwaukee citizens moved north, I noticed that the mall businesses started dwindling less and less. And they had anchor stores there like Sears, JCPenney, you name it, at both of these malls, Capitol Court and Northridge. But as it more and more black citizens moved there, eventually those malls lost business, closed businesses, and evaporated. And it, based upon exactly what you're saying. And another point is I think it's something even more subtle than economics. It's about power. It's the ability to do what you can and what you will against anyone. And that's the big motivator.
Mm-hmm. A reaction to that, John?
No, it's an interesting insight. I think power is important. I think that exactly as a caller alluded to, when we see these subtle changes amongst, you know, the racial mix or the demographics of an area and how that drives entrepreneurs to act in certain ways, I think the caller's spot on. I think economics is always part of it, but it's never all of the story. There are many times other variables that play into the decision as well.
Yeah. So what else surprised you when you researched this book?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the biggest surprises that at least I found is why women earn less money than men in comparable jobs. So when you look at the data, what you find is that even though women have made great strides in the past decade or so in labor markets, you still find women earning 10 to 20% less money than men. You still find women having a really hard time breaking through the glass ceiling. So, you know, there are different explanations for why that might be the case. And we proposed and tested a series of explanations based on competitiveness. And the basic theory is that women are just less competitively inclined than men when it comes to going for the promotion or asking for the pay raise. Women are just much less likely to be as aggressive as men when it comes time to just climb the corporate ladder. So we set out to test that. We started out first with a field experiment where we actually sent out job advertisements all over the U.S. across several cities in the United States, and we asked people to apply to jobs. And the only difference between our two ads was in one case, the potential applicants were told that they would be paid $15 per hour, and in another case, they were told that they would be paid $12 per hour plus a $6 bonus per hour if they outperformed a fellow coworker. Now, what we found was that the men really preferred that second option much more than the women did. So what that meant is that men really liked competitive wage contracts much more than women. So we stepped back and said, okay, that's consistent with the data, but then we said, why are men more competitively inclined than women? So this actually led us to different countries outside the United States. In fact, in one case, we went to Africa, and in another case, we went to India. And I want to talk a little bit about what happened in India, because this is a very fascinating culture. This is a culture called the Kasi Society. And the Kasi Society is really interesting because it's a matrilineal society. Mm. And what I mean by matrilineal society is that this is a society where the women essentially are making the important economic decisions in the household. So as we drove around the villages in Shillong and amongst the Kasi Society, we would see billboards that would essentially say the men are rising up because they want equal rights. So it was much different than what we have here in the States, where, you know, women and minorities have argued for equal rights for decades here in the States. In this particular society, it was men who are asking for equal rights. And when you visit a Cassie household, the man will answer the door. He will take you to the woman of the household. You will then have a conversation with her while the man sits in the corner. Mm-hmm. So it's really a very interesting society that is in much the way reversed to what we have here in the Western world. But what we find in those experiments, when we run similar experiments in the Cassie society, what we observe is that their women act a lot like our men, and their men act a lot like our women. So what I mean by that is their women are more competitively inclined than their men. Their women take more risks and negotiate harder than their men do. So in this way, this was sort of a surprising result to me because it speaks of the power of socialization and how important our society actually is in shaping who we are and how we behave.
Well, that's very interesting. I wish now we had more time to pursue that and some other questions, but we have just a minute to go. What do you hope readers take away from your book or listeners take away from this conversation?
Right. So I hope that readers will take away that there are these big and impervious social questions that are really hard to answer, but with a field experiment and with a glimpse of going out to the real world and using the scientific method, we can actually figure out the hidden motives in the undiscovered economics of everyday life, and we can actually figure out something about ourselves. Why do we do certain things? And I think in the end of the day, our lives can be a lot better once we understand the various issues that we talk about in the Y-axis.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And as a fellow Pointer, I really appreciate being on the show this morning.
Yeah, go Pointers. John List got his bachelor's degree at UW-Stevens Point. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics. He is the co-author of The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing this program and directing it. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you're with us tomorrow at this time. We're going to talk about problems with our food system with the author of The Industrial Diet. That's tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.